My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. If our present situation seems crazy to you, you're in good company. We often hear the word unprecedented used to describe the COVID pandemic, the resultant economic fallout, the egregious murder of George Floyd, and the recognition that racism and racial violence are still very much a part of our culture. Demonstrations and protests fraught with anger and responded to in anger. Leadership that falls short of owning the title, and overt anger, fear, and uncertainty. Is there a way that we may look to spirituality and spiritual practice for direction, clarity, calming, and peace? Is there a spiritual practice for crazy times? Returning to Destination Unlimited this week is Philip Goldberg. Philip Goldberg has been studying the world's spiritual traditions for more than 45 years. He's the author or co-author of some 25 books published in more than a dozen languages. His book, American Veda, was named by Huffington Post and Library Journal as one of the top 10 religion books of 2010. It was followed in 2018 by the popular biography, The Life of Yogananda. He blogs on spirituality and health and co-hosts the Spirit Matters podcast. His website is philipgoldberg.com, and he joins me this week to discuss his new book, Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times, Powerful Tools to Create Calm, Clarity, and Courage. Please join me in welcoming back to Destination Unlimited, Philip Goldberg. Welcome, Phil.
Hey, Victor. Good to be with you again.
And great to have you back. Thank you and congratulations for this wonderful and timely new book. You were last on with me in 2018 discussing your biography on the life of Yogananda. And at the time, I kidded about the fact that we were two boys from Brooklyn talking about Eastern spirituality. For listeners,
Here we go again.
For listeners meeting you for the first time, please share your early path and how it led to your calling.
Well, as you suggested, I was born and raised in Brooklyn, like you, before it was hip and fashionable, but always, you know, this great melting pot of creativity and immigrant development. And then the 60s came, and I was in the spirit of that era. Searching for truth and meaning and purpose and how to be happy and how to live a fulfilled life, as everything around me seemed I didn't fit very well. And I was a political activist, you know, in civil rights and the anti-Vietnam War movement. But in my personal life, having, you know, I was raised by atheists and I hadn't, there was no religion. I had no use for a conventional religion. And then all the other institutions and mainstream sources of guidance seemed to falter. And in that context of the sort of counterculture, books on Indian and Eastern spirituality in general, what we think of as Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, but the spirit of global mystical insight and the practical methods of turning within that came out of the yoga tradition appealed to me a great deal. They seemed to answer a lot of my questions, and they proposed ways of improving from the inside out that did not require my believing in things I couldn't believe in or necessarily, you know, signing on to a belief system or faith. And so I explored, and took up meditation practices, became a meditation teacher, and that era of the late 60s was transforming. And so I've been a student of the world. I expanded my range, you know, and I became a student of all the world's spirituality, and in my professional life as a writer, had opportunity to explore it even further, especially in the last 10 years or so. And that brings us to a spiritual practice for crazy times, which I wrote last year before we knew how crazy the times would be when it was published.
Absolutely. You incarnated into this lifetime about 8 years before I did, so we have a common memory of what unfolded in the 60s and 70s. Our generation was one of hope, of change, of social and political activism, and also of compassion and love. In your view, how did we go from that to what has developed over the last few years? Is this a teachable moment for us?
I hope so. It certainly has the opportunity to be a teachable moment, and I hope people take it as such. And certainly people I know are, in fact, doing that. How it happened, I mean, I have to confess, I was an idealist in those days, and we thought we were changing the world for the better, and in many ways we did. And when I turned essentially from political activism to spiritual activism, thinking, you know, the real way to change the world is from the inside out by, changing people's consciousness and using the methods of meditation and yoga and other spiritual practices to develop the minds and hearts of each individual, that the world would change more profoundly. And what I came to realize is that we need both. We need to pay attention to the inner life of people on an individual basis, and we also need to pay careful attention to what's going on and take our roles as citizens very seriously as well. How this happened, how this degenerated, because, you know, we did. There were a lot of changes. You know, as bad as things are in our racial relations, they're certainly better than they were in the early and mid-60s, you know, when civil rights laws were written and so forth. And, I mean, I remember growing up even in a mixed neighborhood like Brooklyn, you know, to see a mixed race couple was, people were mocked and jeered for that. And even when I was growing up, and now, you know, things are very different. But at the same time, things haven't changed enough, and things in some ways have degenerated. I hope this turns out to be the last gasp of racism and other forms of social ills that keep us down.
Absolutely. You had mentioned that you started writing this book last year and then you added some stuff because of COVID. Historically, there have been pandemics before. The world recovered and moved on. What is different about this one?
Well, for one thing, the medium we're on now, social media, is different. I was, reading some stuff about the what was called the Spanish flu epidemic or pandemic almost exactly 100 years ago. And I was thinking about what it must have been like without television, without radio even, without let alone the internet and the ability to communicate information quickly and as developments happen. That's a huge difference. I think we have a better educated population. For the most part, we have a healthier population, although it could be argued that, they ate better and more naturally back then, before all the processed food and before the air was as polluted as it is now. I also think, to bring it back to my book, we have now access to more information to help us cope and help us use this time for those of us who are blessed enough to be able to develop our spiritually, to learn the lessons from it. As you said earlier, you know, this can be a major teaching moment, both individually and collectively. So I think there's many ways in which this is different from what previous health crises were. But at the same time, it is just as complicated and just as dangerous, if not more so, because of the ease of transportation. I mean, this spread so quickly and so rapidly because of the same technology, the same communication and transportation technologies that are making it easier to cope with. These things are mixed blessings, aren't they?
Absolutely. What would you say, or how would you address those who make the decision not to follow the protocol, not to wear the mask or the procedures? Go ahead.
It disturbs me, you know, a tremendous amount. I mean, I'm, you know, this book is about taking a spiritual approach to crises and difficult times. And as you said, it was written before the pandemic, but really, Victor, all I added, because there was no time at the very latest stages of proofreading and all that, all I did was add a short paragraph about the COVID crisis, and because I realized that everything in the book will apply. I wanted it to be timeless, so you know the advice and information in the book would apply even in the best of times if you're going through, you know, a difficult period in your personal life. But to answer your question, it disturbs me a great deal that people would not be willing to make really a trivial and minor sacrifice to put on a mask when they're out in public. I just went food shopping this morning. So I wore a mask for maybe 20 minutes. It was not a burden. It was, you know, fine. It was easy. I don't understand why people would defy that and put other people at risk, not to mention themselves and their loved ones, in the name of some illusory freedom, when they have no problem driving on the right side of the road or putting on safety belts or not smoking in an indoor setting. We have rules and guidelines for the public good. So I don't understand it. It's a distorted sort of sense of, you know, don't tread on me, that is rather dangerous, I think. You know, true freedom comes from within, and I felt no interference with my freedom when I take a walk with my wife and we put on masks, or I go food shopping like I did this morning. In fact, I think it's an assertion of my freedom to participate in making it, you know, the environment safer.
Not to mention the fact that from a personal moral standpoint, I know by doing this that I'm not only protecting those around me, but protecting my family, my personal situation. Where do you think, just a speculation, where do you think, or your observation, where do you think this generational, because it seems like a lot of young folks are ignoring the mask rules, where do you think this came from?
That's a good question. I think young people always feel invulnerable. I know I did. I mean, look, you know, we were talking about the 60s. Did I take seriously the advice of my elders that the drugs I was experimenting with might have been dangerous? Did I care about hitchhiking and the possible dangers of that? You know, young people, you know, always have that feeling of the bravery and. But I think it was amplified in this case by the erroneous suggestion that young people are somehow not vulnerable to this virus, because the early indications were that very young people don't, you know, when they get it, don't have the the same level of pathological symptoms that older people did. And that may be true, but they could still transmit it to others. And people in their 20s and 30s are not the same as people who are 8 or 10 years old. And they're carriers, and they're in hospitals now, too. So this sense of invulnerability and the sense of don't have these grown-ups, these fastidious conservative grown-ups tell us we can't go to bars and party. You know, it's a very immature way to be young, but seems to be prevalent.
And I wonder if the fact that certain leadership also failed to wear the protective masks sent out the wrong message.
Absolutely. We can't deny that. It's not only that they failed to wear the masks and model appropriate behavior. They were actively suggesting it's an individual choice and it's, hey, no big deal. Certain people in power even, refused to put in regulations that would mandate that people follow safety procedures. There's a kind of libertarian, leave us alone strain in the American zeitgeist lately that, I understand where it's coming from, but it could be very dangerous when it's taken to this kind of extreme. We have a lot of politicians, I'll try not to name names, but it should be obvious, that, are putting their election chances ahead of public safety. We have to acknowledge that.
Absolutely. So I ask you now, how do we find balance in the era of COVID-19?
Well, as I've said a couple of times, I wrote Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times early. I started writing it early 2019 or in the spring because times were crazy then. And I had a lot of people struggling with, the political and social atmosphere of the era. And I thought, I've learned a lot over my years, and there's a lot of great guidance. So maybe I should put it in a book form. And I discussed it with my publisher, Hay House, and we said, let's go for it. And when I wrote it in the matter of 5 or 6 months last year, and we slated it for publication this August, right now, and thinking, well, times were crazy when I wrote it, and times will be crazier in 2020 leading up to the election. And then came January and February. I was in India when the crisis hit in China and started to spread. I was on my way back from India when, Italy shut down. And I came back and proofread the book, and we thought, should we change it? And we thought, no, the advice applies. But when March or April hit and we were all in lockdown, the publisher and I brought out the digital version, the e-book, the Kindle and so forth version, early. Because that could be done technologically, and made it available for $1.99. So in a sense, the book's been available for a few months, even though the paper version is now coming out, because we couldn't change the date of that. So the whole point of the book, if I have to summarize it in one sentence or one concept, it's that all the world's spiritual teachings have told us for thousands of years, and still do, that we, each of us, has within us what I call an inner sanctuary and a fortress of strength. It's our innermost being. At our core, we have perfect peace. We have contentment. We have awakened knowledge and consciousness. And the degree to which we can access that and infuse its qualities into our lives, we have the opportunity to maintain inner calm, to have refuge within ourselves, regardless of what's going on around us. But I make an important point, and most of the book is about how to get access to that inner sanctuary, how to find inner peace in the midst of circumstances and cultivate it and make it part of your life. But it's also, it's not an escape. And I make a strong point of that, and I want to emphasize it here because, you know, of all the things we've talked about already, this is a crisis period. And it means we all have to take responsibility as citizens. And access to this inner sanctuary is also a platform for more effective action.
Absolutely. My guest is Philip Goldberg. He's the author of the new book, Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times. We'll be back with more Phil after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
America, your children have an amazing superpower. That's right. They can help save lives by simply washing their hands. Just 20 seconds of thorough hand washing after they've coughed or sneezed or been outside can help fight against the dastardly spread of germs. Armed with only soap and water and hands, your superhero can protect you, your family, and everyone out there in America land. Amazing! Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
So I'm a cat. And I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
On Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, Philip Goldberg, the author of the new book, Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times. Phil, you wrote an amazing essay entitled Spiritual Responsibility in the Age of Black Lives Matter. To quote a line from that essay, you said, "Our long overdue moment of reckoning is a spiritual challenge, not just a social or a political one. We're called upon to stretch beyond our comfort zones, to introspect rigorously and self-assess honestly. What do we as a society and spiritually centered people in particular need to do?"
As that passage suggests, a time of introspection for each of us. I was moved to write that, and it's on my blog on spirituality and health online, because, you know, I've been an anti-racist, you know, from childhood. I was raised by, you know, anti-racist, anti-bigotry New York liberals, and I grew up with, you know, Jackie Robinson as a family hero, and my mother having African American friends, and going to an integrated schools, and having black playmates and teammates and all that. So, and then I was a civil rights, you know, activist in college, and so I always thought of myself as not having to learn much about, you know, racism. And I always, I mean, we didn't call it structural racism when I was in college, but we knew that, you know, racism was institutionally supported and propagated. But when Black Lives Matter came into prominence and the term white privilege came, I was moved by a couple of black friends to look at it myself. And I thought, my God, even I have a lot to learn. Despite all my background and upbringing, I have a lot to learn as well. So imagine people who didn't have grow up in an integrated neighborhood, may never have known black people when they were young. We all have a lot to learn. And I call it a spiritual crisis because, to me, spirituality is about individual transformation and opening our hearts and recognizing our common humanity and our interrelatedness. And if we don't get that we're all connected in the midst of a worldwide crisis of infectious disease, will never. I mean, it nothing could be more obvious than how interconnected we are, and how the quality of life of one person or one group affects everybody else. If we can't become spiritually more generous, less greedy, less self-centered. These are all spiritual qualities, compassion and empathy. This is an opportunity for us to develop those qualities in ourselves. We're being called to do that. And it not only is a social necessity, but it's good for us individually, being more compassionate, being more empathetic, being less materialistic, less selfish, makes us happier, makes us more content, makes us feel better about ourselves, makes us better parents, makes us better neighbors, better citizens. It makes the world a nicer place to be in. So I see this as, as much a spiritual crisis and a spiritual necessity as it is a social or political one.
Absolutely. I grew up in, you're familiar probably with Borough Park in Brooklyn.
Yes.
And my neighborhood when I grew up was primarily Jewish people, Eastern European Jews, Italian folks, some Irish folks.
Right.
And in the late 1950s, early 1960s, the city had passed laws where that folks or black children from other neighborhoods would be bussed into our neighborhood. Mm. When I didn't know the difference between a person with, other than the color of their skin, I didn't see them any differently. I was raised in a home where we were taught to love everyone and respect everyone. And I made friends instantly with a lot of these kids. Mm-hmm. And because I did, my white friends started disowning me.
Really?
And
wow.
Some of their parents actually said, stay away from the N-word lover, referring to me.
Jeez.
And it was very traumatic for me. I didn't understand why this was happening. I had no concept as to why my friendship with black children had any effect on my friendship with anybody else. It did not make sense to me in my heart. And it was very painful and hurtful. And not that I'll ever understand what it's like to be African-American, to be black. I'll never understand that because not having that
right.
skin color, I've never been exposed to that type of thing. But I have a taste for that and a great compassion and a great sympathy and a great empathy and a great desire to embrace everyone. So perhaps it was a hard lesson, but a good lesson.
Yes, and I had a similar, I grew up in a similar neighborhood, with the one exception being that we were close enough to a black enclave so that our school and the buses and subways were much more integrated than it sounds like yours was. Mm-hmm. And so from kindergarten on, I had black classmates, and I was an athletic kid. And, you know, and my father would take me to see the Dodgers play, and we would, you know, root for Jackie Robinson, and the stands were all integrated. And so, and my mother was, you know, she campaigned to have a black friend of hers be president of the PTA when I was in the sixth grade. Mm. And what I never understood, and you experienced it as well, we both grew up around first, second, third generation immigrants, and you know, with immigrant backgrounds, Jews and Italian and Irish Catholics, all of whom were discriminated against in earlier generations. And you would think that that heritage would immunize you from being bigoted yourself. Yeah. But it didn't always play that way, and that was always shocking to me, and still is, frankly.
Yeah. No answer. I don't have the answer. And perhaps in our wisdom, in retrospect, in the next lifetime, we will have changed, I hope. I briefly mentioned our respective activism back in the 60s and 70s. I remember that much of that was predicated on not only wanting change, but that change was motivated by compassion. Most of today's activism seems to be anger-based. Can anger and outrage be a healthy and meaningful approach to effect change?
You know, funny you should ask, because I also wrote a different essay on spirituality and health about the uses of anger. Because I find myself being very angry at times, and I keep saying to myself, Phil, you've been on a spiritual path for over 50 years. You taught meditation. You teach people to be calm inside, to be loving and, you know, to develop through these methods. You wrote a whole book about it, and here you are being angry and, you know, essentially, you know, yelling at the television when the news tells you certain things. And then I realized, you know, that anger in and of itself is neither a bad thing nor a good thing. It's what do you do when that anger hits you? When you know, John Lewis, whose death we are mourning as we're recording this interview, was angry. Martin Luther King was angry. Gandhi was angry. The American founders were angry at the Brits, but they channeled that. They didn't just lash out. That initial anger was toned and modified and transformed individually and collectively for the people involved in Gandhi's independence movement, for people in the civil rights movement, the people who were doing nonviolent protests. They converted the anger into, you know, what we might consider indignation or outrage, something controllable, something that could be channeled into a compassionate, loving response to changing things, to solving serious problems without the lashing out that if you don't transform the anger, just makes things worse. So right now we're seeing this situation in Portland, Oregon, and you know, the overwhelming majority of people protesting are angry, but they're converting that anger into peaceful and creative forms of protest. And the few people who can't do that or don't want to do that are making things worse by, you know, lashing out. And the response to it by the administration sending in troops is a, you know, another way that anger is not being, you know, channeled in a constructive way. So to me, anger is a driver. It's a force. It's like a physiological response to something. But it, you know, it we all know the harm it does. Just, you know, even if you get angry at your child and to say or do something you shouldn't. But on a societal level, it's really dangerous. But it can be channeled into a constructive, loving movement or action on an individual basis. There's a lot of stuff about that in my book, actually.
Yes. In your book, Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times, you paraphrase Bob Dylan by saying, the times they are a crazy. How should those grounded in spiritual practice view these times?
Well, they're crazy and they're unprecedented. But as one of the people, I have a lot of endorsements for the book that I cherish because they're from people I greatly respect. And one of them said, the times are crazy, but you don't have to be. And I thought I should have used that in my book myself, because, you know, we can remain sane. We, you know, all the spiritual practices, all the methods that I marshal in the book, you know, are designed to bring you to the, you know, place within us of that's at peace and is wise and is conscious and compassionate and loving. We can retain some of that. The Bhagavad Gita, which is a, you know, sacred text I always return to, has a passage about the wise being having equanimity, you know, that inner contentment in the midst of gain or loss, victory or defeat, pleasure or pain. And that equanimity can be cultivated despite what's going on around us. And that not only protects us, it's a form of self-protection and refuge, but it's also a platform for us to then engage the crazy world and in our own way, however limited, making it a little bit more sane. You know, as the Jewish tradition has this thing called Tikkun Olam, which is to heal a piece of the broken world.
Yes,
and we can all do that. Well, even if it's just, you know, being kinder to our neighbors in the midst of this pandemic, even if it means helping somebody who is destitute or, you know, getting out the vote or whatever it may be, just being a better parent, you know, at a time when, you know, kids may be home from school. All these things matter. And the more we have inner peace and access to our own inner source of wisdom, the better we can do it.
Staying spiritually sane in the midst of madness.
Yes. Well put.
Which is actually from your book, so.
Yes, thank you. But I thought it might be a direct quote, but I didn't. I wanted to give you credit.
No, thank you. No, but you can give me credit for sharing the same concept with you. I have the same feeling and the same idea. Many with spiritual practice are used to gathering with their respective communities, sanghas, churches, temples, or sanctuaries. With physical distancing, some have found this community online, but many have not. How may we look within to find that special place?
Well, I'm a big advocate of personal spiritual practice on a regular basis. And I advocate this not as a, you know, a form of religion, although if it is for you, that's great. But, you know, even for secular people, the methods that the spiritual traditions have come up with can be understood in a secular way, in a practical way. These are practical interventions for self-improvement, for cultivating the qualities of inner peace and higher consciousness that have been very well documented in scientific research. So whether you're religious or you're an atheist, whether you're spiritual or secular, these kinds of methods, especially meditation, have proven value. And I strongly advocate, as I do in the early chapters, finding methods that work for you. There's instructions in the book. There's guidelines for looking outside of the, you know, what a book can provide. And finding a routine that works for you in your life. This is, to me, a central issue. And then there's methods to add and so forth and to use at other times of the day.
And we're going to discuss some of those practices in the next segment. My guest is Philip Goldberg, is the author of Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times. We'll be back with more Phil after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Hey, Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hi, this is David Strickle. I'm excited to share my brand new show, The Stream of David Live, right here on Om Times Radio. Each week, I'll have exciting guests, and I'll channel the eternal wisdom of the stream, a group of non-physical entities whose teachings have transformed lives all over the world. So join us for an uplifting hour each Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern. That's The Stream of David Live, right here on Om Times Radio.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
A social distancing tip.
Keeping your distance from others is important in slowing the spread of coronavirus. So here are some fun things to do alone. Read a book, take a walk, unpack your suitcase from that trip you took last September, paint a self-portrait, catch up on a TV series, do a puzzle. Remember, we should all stay home to lower the risk for everyone. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, everyone. Al Roker here. As a guy with his own catchphrase, I appreciate that after 75 years... Smokey's only said,
only you can prevent wildfires.
But I'm filling in because there's a lot more to report. Like when it's dry or windy. Be careful burning yard waste, because wildfires can even start in your neck of the woods. Go to SmokeyBear.com to learn more about wildfire prevention. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
On Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, Philip Goldberg, is the author of the brand new book, Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times, Powerful Tools to Cultivate Calm, Clarify, and Courage. Phil, you suggest that we create an inventory of practices to get us through these troubled times. What should we include in that inventory?
Well, as I said in the last segment, I advocate having a consistent spiritual practice that works for you, or practices that you could do on a routine daily basis, as routine as you take a shower or brush your teeth or do, you know, exercise and all that. It's ongoing spiritual maintenance or mind-body maintenance. In addition, I advocate that people do, to whatever degree of formality is comfortable for them. Essentially, what I realized I had done over the years, but never did it as a formal practice. I had accumulated methods that I can turn to at any time as needed to return to that inner core of peace and stability and find a refuge from whatever's going on, or to lift my spirit. And I realized I do these things. And so I advocate that people create an inventory And I suggest breaking it down into time segments from small periods of time, like less than 5 minutes, or if you want, even less than 2 or 3 minutes to 5 minutes, and then, you know, up to 15 minutes or up to a half hour or half hour to an hour, and longer periods, including things you might do for a whole day or a week or a month. Those are obviously, there are fewer things in that category, like going on retreat, taking a, you know, long-awaited vacation. But in the shorter time frames, it could be anything from certain breathing practices that, you know, could take just a few seconds or a minute, or physical exercises like the ones from the yoga tradition that, you know, stuff is happening. You just need to regain your center. You just do these things. It could take, you know, a minute or two. It could mean shutting off your devices and just closing your eyes and doing a guided meditation, putting a guided meditation on a tape, or just listening to, you know, a really truly uplifting song, or going, you know, taking a walk around the block or in a nearby park, or prayer, if you're inclined toward prayer. These things don't take long. And if you have an inventory of them in written form, when the moment comes and you say, I'm rattled, I'm agitated, I'm upset, what can I do here to regain my center? After a while, you don't need to consult the written documents. You'll know, you'll intuit what to do, and you'll have it at your fingertips. So I mean, there's a vast repertoire to choose from. And so I have guidelines in the book for creating such an inventory.
Is inner peace only a breath away?
It is. You're quoting me again.
Yes, I am.
Yes. And the reason I say that is because one of the more immediate and effective ways to retain or regain a sense of inner peace, just to calm the agitation, is deep breaths. And there's, you know, the yoga tradition has hundreds and hundreds of exercises for doing this. And I have a few simple ones in the book. But even just pausing and taking a deep breath, especially an abdominal breath where you extend the abdomen so your lungs fill more completely. And then on the exhale, to exhale about 50% longer than the inhale. That's an added benefit of a deep breath, for which there's a great deal of research. I explain the physiology of it in the book, but it's quite simple, actually. It affects the nervous system in a very positive way to expel more of the carbon dioxide than you might normally do. And then again, you know, deep breaths. And you're just doing this, it could takes less than a minute. And it can have tremendous benefit. And of course, there's also practices, breathing practices, that you can do for a longer period of time that are, you know, even more effective.
What practices should we use? What do you recommend before and after meditation?
Well, I'm a big advocate of breathing methods that have been developed in the yoga tradition called pranayama, and the physical stretches and bends that we associate with yoga, the asana, the postures. You don't have to be, you know, a big yogi to do these things. You just have to learn a few stretches and bends that are comfortable for you. I also have instructions for progressive relaxation for those who find, you know, it difficult to get up and stretch and bend. There are methods for tensing and relaxing the muscles. Doing this and some breathing before meditation are good for settling the body and mind more, so you have a deeper meditation. There, some people like to have a prayer before they meditate, or an invocation of some kind, perhaps a chant or a song. And these are also effective. Those can also be done after meditation. So people have different routines that suit their needs and their spiritual orientations.
In spiritual practice for crazy times, you say that we should practice the spiritual two-step and help the world from the inside out. Please teach us this dance.
This, I alluded to it earlier, this sanctuary of peace and fortress of strength within us is not only a refuge, it's a foundation for acting more effectively in the world. And in normal times, it just might mean, you know, because you have, you turn within each day and do spiritual practices as needed, you come out and you're, you know, a better parent. You're a better professional, whatever you do. You're a better nurse. You're a better doctor. You're a better bus driver, you know, whatever. And these are proven methods that, you know, scientific research has verified as having those effects. So I call it a spiritual two-step. You turn within and bring out those inner qualities and then engage the world and take your responsibilities as a citizen, as a family member, as a professional, as a, you know, member of an occupation, and do it with more integrity, with more compassion, with more skill. There's a term in Sanskrit called upaya, which means skillful means. And everything we do should be done with skillful means so that we do it more effectively and have a better impact on the world. And the world improves through these small gestures that each of us does. Each of us do on our own in our own lives, that influence spreads. You're kinder to somebody you run into; they'll in turn feel better and be kinder to someone else. You're more compassionate. You're more tuned in if you're politically oriented or you're involved in wanting to make the social justice movement more effective. Whatever it is you do, you'll do it more effectively and with the, you know, spiritual qualities that we all value of love and compassion and wisdom. And so that's why I call it a spiritual two-step. For too many years and in too many people's lives, being spiritual often means escaping the world and disengaging. And I think that's a misconception, and it's not what is called for in these times. We need engaged spiritual people who can help make the world a little saner.
You also offer some immediate interventions we can employ when crises erupt. Can you give a couple of them to us now?
Yeah, well, we've talked about breathing. And one immediate thing anybody can do in those moments is engage the senses. You're rattled, and you can't just leave a situation and go meditate or, you know, pray or go to a church or a park. But you can, even inconspicuously, take a deep breath. You can touch something. The sense of touch, or even the other senses, but sense of touch is easier and somehow more immediate. And put your attention on that in the moment sensory experience, touching the chair, touching your knee, putting your hand in your pocket. Some people carry an amulet or something, you know, sacred or sentimental, like a stone from their honeymoon or something, and just feeling that in your hand brings you back to your center quickly, even if it's just temporary, but it's a moment of centering. And there's many other things we can do as well.
What would you like your readers to take away from spiritual practice for crazy times?
The commitment to creating a deeper spiritual routine for themselves, to deepen the practices they already engage in, to expand their repertoire so they broaden their spiritual basis and deepen it, and to remember that there is an inner sanctuary within ourselves, and that is should be our first stop. It's, you know, to invoke Jesus, seek ye first the kingdom of God. And in the yoga tradition, it's establish yourself in yoga and then perform action. So to remember that your spiritual foundation within you is a high priority and should be a matter of routine, and that that will make you a better parent, spouse, professional, whatever, as well.
My guest, Philip Goldberg, his new book, Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times. Phil, please share with our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and all of this wonderful work.
Wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the online places that you are limited to now in the absence of bookstores. When bookstores open again, it should be there. And you can find me at philipgoldberg.com. Or my podcast, SpiritMattersTalk.com. And I hope you'll stay in touch. And I'm offering a free guided meditation instruction for people who buy the book. And you'll find instructions for that on my website.
Phil, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this valuable information for those who are listening.
Thank you, Victor, for the great conversation. I appreciate it.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.